Hello folks, welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. My name's Simon Ward, and you're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast. Now, before we start on today's guest, I just wanted to let you know that you are a high performance human, despite what you might think. Now, this concept of high performance is described as a measurable state where an individual, which is you, consistently performs at a higher level of operational success compared with most of their peers within the same environment at a particular time. Now, if you're an endurance athlete and you train to compete regularly, you probably compare yourself against all of those other athletes, and that might be where you think that you're not high performance. But instead of that, thinking about the other folks of your age compared to them, and these are people that you work with or you grew up with, or some of your social friends, you are operating at a very high level. Now, because of that, I appreciate you might still want to improve. And if that's the case, then we would love to help you. We being my wife, who's a certified life coach, and myself. And we've both got availability to take on a few clients. And we could be talking about working with you on your sleep, your nutrition, physical activity, personal relationships, work habits, and so much more. So depending on what you're looking to focus on, we've got you covered, and you can find contact details in the show notes. Okay, now we're going on to today's guest. And if you search back through podcast archives from my podcast, you'll find conversations with experts that I've had about all the major joints in the body, the back, the knees, the ankles, the feet, but so far I've not covered shoulders. Now, for most endurance athletes, these are not as troublesome as some of those other joints I've just mentioned, but they still take a lot of hammer. Countless meters in the pool and the occasional and painful impact from falling off your bike or stumbling over while you're running. And not to mention the daily postural challenges from everyday living. So, it gives me great pleasure to introduce on today's podcast Mr. Tim Stevenson of Dynamic Shoulders. Tim's a strength coach who started on the specialisation journey, like many folks, by overcoming his own shoulder problems. He then worked as a strength coach in para swimming, which gave him a real insight into folks who often depend more on their upper body and their arms and shoulders than other limbs. So in the conversation, we talk about the shoulder complex and its interaction with other joints, shoulder stability and how to achieve it. We bust a couple of common myths about training shoulders, and we talk about the influence of modern living and how it can lead to poor shoulder health. Finally, we talk about how you can look after your shoulders and the benefits of ground-based exercises, which are often overlooked, and some specifics for you swimmers and triathletes out there. So let's crack on and hear from Tim. Oh, welcome to the show, Tim Stevenson.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to dive into some shoulder conversation.
Yeah, well, me too, actually, partly from a selfish perspective, because I've had a few shoulder injuries in my life, and also because I feel like I've done all of the other key joints now, and shoulders is the one that's sort of outstanding. So here we are covering that final base. So it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So as I said in the intro, you know, you're a shoulder specialist. You have this business called Dynamic Shoulders. But I know you don't come from a physiotherapy background. You're more strength and conditioning. So we should probably set the scene and talk about how you got to this particular point of being the man that people turn to when they need to get the shoulders working properly.
Great. Well, yeah, I'll give you a short history. I'll try and keep it short. To wrap that sentence up, or the answer to that question in quite a short sentence, is I've kind of been there and had the problems with the shoulders, which kind of puts me in a situation which is sometimes quite different to people who are rehabilitating shoulders, because I know what it's like to have problems. So that journey started when I was about 18 or 19 at university, playing rugby, dislocated my shoulder for the first time. We were on a rugby tour at the time, and there was more important things to do on rugby tour than go to A&E. So we went for a few drinks, as we do, and then just carried on playing. So it come out in a tackle, hit the ground, gone back in. I was like, okay. So you play again and dislocates again. And that process went on, or that cycle repeats itself for a while, until I had a scan, and then they decided to go and do a surgery. So I had a labral tear, which effectively a tear in the fibrocartilage labrum around that keeps the shoulder a little bit more secure in the socket. So the humeral head just sliding effectively out of its anatomical location under certain positions or stresses, which was at that time rugby. So I had the surgery and then I did all the rehabilitation. I actually lived abroad for a few years. I used to be a scuba diving instructor. So I went on and lived a beach bum lifestyle for a while. So that meant not playing rugby. Came back, started playing again, started dislocating again, and then ended up having a second surgery because the original surgery had failed. At the same time as that second surgery, I was starting my strength and conditioning career. So I needed to be able to do my Olympic lifts for the UKSCA assessment. I was starting to really get into coaching, and that meant that I sort of nailed the rehab the second time around, because that the surgery and the rehab and the strength and conditioning all lined up. So I effectively used myself as a case study, which has been the story of my strength and conditioning career to date. And this was 15, sort of 16 years ago. I started strength and conditioning around 2008. So I went through the rehab, nailed it, and then got signed off by the physio, and then was told that I was good to go. So I could go back to doing whatever I wanted to be able to do. And I had absolutely no confidence in my shoulder at that point, because there's obviously the brain component of that as well, in terms of the how safe you feel. Plus the training I'd done was all very low intensity. So we had done lying on a board, lying on my back, balancing a stability board in my hand. I'd done the most amount of yellow TheraBand internal external rotation work. And it's just, you put me back into a position like overhead where most people will feel unstable if they've had a shoulder instability issue or trauma. And I still felt like really sketchy in that shape. So I decided that I was going to take things into my own hands. And my thought experiment was, if I can learn to handstand, that will give me some confidence that my shoulders are stable. So I took myself down a real deep dive into calisthenics. So the first time that I went to go and try a handstand, and I've got no gymnastics background whatsoever, I was in South Africa, but my wife's parents have got a place on the sea just outside Cape Town, a town called Hermanus, and it overlooks the ocean. So I'm out there on the deck and I'll put my hands on the ground and I'm like, I actually don't know if my shoulder's going to stay in the socket if I do this. It was that kind of like, it was that bad. I dislocated on my UKSCA lifting assessment with Gil Stevenson with a snatch balance and unloaded bar. So 20 kilo bar popped overhead and slipped my shoulder. So I'd been in a fairly bad place with it. So I started learning to handstand, and that led to other calisthenics movements like back levers, started playing around with human flags, and the human flag would put me in exactly the same position that I really didn't like from dislocation perspective. So overhead, externally rotated. But we, when I say we, it was myself and my business partner, Dave Jackson, we started exploring this calisthenics training methodology, and my shoulders just like felt amazing. So I'd all of a sudden just built a ton of confidence in them. And to the point where I was doing things I would never thought I would be able to do. In and around that, or at the same time, I was also building through my strength and conditioning career. So I'd done a lot of work in Paralympic sport, which is where I really found my specialism. I was involved in Paralympic swimming quite heavily for about 10 years. So I was starting to also build out this knowledge of, from a professional perspective, of going, how do we prepare the shoulder for elite sport? My own experience, plus the calisthenics journey that I was going on. So now I've got this like really potent melting pot of things that were super helpful. And we were getting feedback from coaches at the time. We were kind of putting loads of calisthenics content out, and coaches in strength and conditioning were coming back and saying, look, when I do this stuff, my shoulder feels amazing. When I stop, it doesn't feel so good anymore. So I kind of went to the literature base and was like, okay, what are we doing here? And essentially, to kind of wrap it up and where the opportunity came from, is if we look at what physiotherapists are doing from a rehabilitation perspective, in terms of, let's take a shoulder, a variety of different injuries, but let's take mine from a dislocation perspective. You go through a surgery, you come back, the physio's job is to regain range of motion, develop neuromuscular control. And if they are confident with working with the shoulder, they'll also do some kinetic chain integration work at the same time. All I was doing was taking those same principles, but scaling them to a much greater intensity so that my shoulder could handle things of a greater intensity, like getting back to Olympic weightlifting and pressing overhead and other stuff.
I've always thought, and I, you know, this is no slight on any physios out there, but I used to have a personal training gym 20 odd years ago, and my business partner had a physio clinic, and there was always a gap between getting somebody back to being pain free and having good range of movement to getting them back to performance level fitness. And it seems like that's what you're talking about here, is okay, your shoulder's repaired and it's healed, you've got a good range of movement, now you can go and play rugby. And it's the lack of confidence and that performance level that you're filling in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, an example that I use is, if someone told me that I could go back and play rugby, if I was like, okay, we're good in the traditional kind of sagittal plane press and pull patterns. And then I've got the chaos of rugby, and I'm not a big guy. I probably come at like 78 kilos. And at that time I was light. This was before I really got into strength training. I've got a guy who's weighing maybe 120 kilos coming at me from an awkward angle. I'm just going to go and stick my arm out and try and hand the guy off or absorb a tackle or whatever. That's a very different situation to lying on the back with a stability ball. So the analogy that we use is the injury is puts you at the bottom of a cliff. Physio will get me oftentimes to the top of the cliff, but what I need to do is move you like as far as I can away from that cliff edge so that I've got all of that bandwidth to be able to play with. And that comes down to having to train the shoulder in a different way to what is traditionally prescribed.
So, you know, just before we started, we were talking about my knee injury and this ACL thing, and the current discussion is, should I have surgery or should I not have surgery? And things have changed since, you know, some of the other people I knew that would automatically have surgery after that. And also to do with my age, they're saying, well, you can quite be quite effective without an ACL if you do all of this type of stuff that you're talking about for the hips, the quads, you know, the balance, proprioception. And one of the comments that the specialist made was, just because you have surgery doesn't mean everything's going to be all right. You've got to be really diligent with the strength and performance stuff on top of that. So, you know, to have the best outcomes, you've got to have good surgery or good treatment and be diligent and stick to the plan with your surgery to get you back to the performance level you were at before. And I think, again, that's sometimes led by somebody like yourself. And that's also, you've got to have a performance mindset from the person who you're working with as well.
Yeah. And there's so much in there that over the years has resonated. So I heard Nick Winkelman once say, early to ripe, early to rotten. So if we put new skills and attributes in and we don't maintain them, then they'll drop off quickly. The same thing is if what happens traditionally with rehabilitation is that people will do the exercises until it stops hurting because they're relatively boring and they don't actually feel like a proper training program. So the pain is a good reminder that you are not fixed yet. As soon as you get pain free, it doesn't mean that you're actually ready to go back to CrossFit or swimming distance or whatever it might be, playing rugby. So to getting somebody back to sport, and this is a Bill Knowles kind of quote, is relatively straightforward. Sustaining that participation at a competitive level is actually much more difficult.
So I used to, about 15, 20 years ago, I was working at Yorkshire Cricket as fitness conditioner, and I was one of the first folks who was in cricket then. There was, I can't think of the guy who was the first full-time conditioner at England then, but Yorkshire were the first county really that had one. So I was working with people like Darren Goff and Tim Bresnan. Johnny Bairstow and Joe Root were in the academy, but there was Silverwood, Michael Vaughan. We used to spend a lot of time working with the kids in the academy that were 14 or 15. And Scott McAllister was the physio then. And Scott and I used to work together because when we were identifying the injury, Scott was saying, oh, the kids have got lots of shoulder problems. They're over bowled. You know, they're 14 or 15. They're doing too many overs. They've got back problems. We need to do something to fix it. So we came up with this plan. And it was, compared to what we're going to talk to about today, I think it was still fairly simple, but there was a lot of TheraBand work, a lot of dynamic overhead work, a lot of balancing. We did a lot of groundwork, bear crawls and stuff like that, which they probably weren't called bear crawls then, but I figured that if you're doing stuff, you know, on the floor and getting up off the floor is a part of an athlete's, you know, repertoire anyway. One morning, Scott and I were chatting and we taught the kids to get on with this stuff before we got on with anything else. So they all had their own little kit and they were all busy in their little pods doing their work. And one of them came over and he said, Waddy, do I have to keep doing this stuff before every session? And Scott said, why would you ask that question? He said, I haven't been injured for 2 years now. And we both laughed. And Scott said, that's the reason why you need to keep doing it. Yeah. And that you know, that conversation 20 years ago now, but it sticks in my mind as something that you're just talking about there is it's the ongoing work that protects you, not just the stuff you've done to get there.
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff, I'm not being dismissive about like lower intensity shoulder stabilizing exercises. They have a place and they're a big part of our training program. But the piece is the protection comes in the form of strength, not through low intensity exercises. So we have to get people stronger. Now, when people hear that, they're like, okay, I'll go and do pull-ups and bench. That'll get me strong. And that's not the answer. So lots of people run into problems where the strength program looks like that, but then they're going to go and try and play a sport which is way more multidirectional. Mm-hmm. And I use the word chaotic because the shoulder's job is to position the hand in space. So if we're in a sports-based environment, the brain is thinking about what do I need to be able to do with the hand, and the shoulder is going to be the collection of joints, let's say, that's going to execute that athletic expression. So we need to be able to move into lots of different ways. And if it's a contact sport or there's high forces involved, we need to have that shoulder trained and prepared to manage those forces. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're going into a rugby environment and all of a sudden we've got to go and throw a shoulder out, or even throwing a cricket ball. Like, throwing is a huge amount of research in shoulders in throwing sports. It can just be that fatigue of the shoulder. It's a long test match or whatever it is that mm-hmm. it just tips it over the edge. So if we prepare for chaos, and people might sound that sounds a bit extreme, but it's really not. It's preparing for athleticism. And I talk a lot about physical literacy. If we have a shoulder which is designed to position the hand in space, we need to be able to train that shoulder in all the different ranges of where we might want to position that hand, not just lying on a bench pressing a barbell.
I think, you know, particularly for the triathletes and swimmers and cyclists that are listening to this, they might think, well, this whole thing about chaos is alien to me, because I understand we used to always talk about chaos sports versus endurance sports, where the movements are pretty much repetitive and they're the same. But still, it's not always the same, is it? You know, if you're swimming in the ocean and you're just about to put your hand in the water and you get smashed by a big wave, if you're not strong enough to withstand that or react to it, then that could leave you with a problem. Equally, if you're about to put your arm in the water and you catch somebody else's arm that's coming the other way, that's going to pull your shoulder in a position that it's not used to. So you don't get as many chaotic movements in swimming and biking and running, but you do get some, and you need to be prepared for it.
Yeah, and let's flip that for the swimming particularly, because workload management can be chaotic if it's not programmed properly. Mm-hmm. So if we have got volume spiking all over the place because either someone's writing their own program or the coach is programming, and that's an absolute, like, that's horrendous from a shoulder perspective. We can't have super high volume 1 week, then drop it off and then go another one. That'll piss the shoulder off pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. From just a volume perspective as well, like, chaos can be, it makes people think you think about like disorder or would be more of a kind of textbook definition. But I mean, we have a condition called swimmer's shoulder, which people are sometimes diagnosed. And there was a research paper that came out not so long ago around predictors of injury in swimming. And you start to go, well, actually some of those are relatively avoidable, because if we can prepare the shoulder appropriately for the demands we're going to place upon it. So that's maybe a better way of looking at it when we get it into a triathlon, swimming, running type perspective, because we're going to spend a lot of time doing freestyle swimming, which is going to be anterior shoulder dominant. We're going to spend a lot of time on a bike, which is a hunched over, which is going to create more anterior dominance of the shoulder. And then we run, we're typically, if we get tired, are going to be relatively, we can quite quickly find ourselves into the same pattern. So all of a sudden, we're going to have a strength imbalance from front to back. We're going to have our length tension relationships, or the shoulder's ability to be able to generate and produce force is going to be out of alignment. And then all of a sudden, we've got shoulders which grumble and they niggle and they get frustrated. They get frustrating because we've got these kind of minor complaints that mean that we can't push on, or we get into a certain distance in a swim session, the shoulder starts hurting. Like, all of that is what we're talking about as to how we prepare the shoulder for the demands we want to place upon it.
Well, and of course, if we throw into the mix everyday living, sitting in front of a computer, driving, you know, watching the telly, everything happens in front of us, doesn't it? And it's since I started lifting weights when I was 16, you could always tell that people would work the muscles that they saw in the mirror. So the back of the body would get neglected. So now everybody talks about the posterior chain, but still they're neglected from the perspective of a lot of people. But
yeah,
going back to what you were just saying there about that load prescription, I know quite a few swimmers who are doing Ironman, for instance. So that's a 3.8K swim in the race. But they're good enough to swim the time fairly close to the time they want to come out of the water. So let's just say that's 1 hour. They could probably do that off two sessions of 45 minutes a week, because they've built the skills up as a child and they're very efficient. My argument to them is, but if your shoulders are tired because you're not used to swimming 4K in a wetsuit with that little bit of resistance and the rubber, and you're in open water, then you're going to have fatigued shoulders when you get on the bike, and then having rested on aero bars for most of the day. You're then going to get off. Everything's going to be tired here. So now all of a sudden your posture's impaired, your breathing skills are impaired because you're folding in at the torso. You know, that's going to have an impact on your performance when you get tired in the run. And it, for a lot of people, it just goes straight over the head.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think like particularly the run, like the if we look at efficiency and economy around how the upper body's contributes to running performance, like you said, the breathing work is a big piece as well as how easily it is to you try and breathe when you've got you're all closed down the anterior chain. Like it's not as straightforward. But I think, I mean, you'll know this from your background, but if we were to look at how we prepare a strength and conditioning or physical preparation program, the whole point of the program really from the primary concern is keep people training.
Mm-hmm.
And then performance comes as a secondary of that because we know that injured athletes can't win medals. So if we can if we construct our program around that, so we go, what are the demands of the sport? So if we take that triathlon or the Ironman disciplines, we just know that we should be probably doing a lot more horizontal pulling work, a lot more shoulder work from different angles and perspectives. We don't really arguably need to be able to do a lot of horizontal pressing because we don't need that force generation. And I've had many arguments with swim coaches over the years that we can't swim fast freestyle unless we can bench press 150 kilos. And I will always question that methodology because I don't see where you can apply that force in the water. So you'd be much better off. Like I'm a big fan and proponent of gymnastics rings. For most people, using pieces of equipment like that in those sports will give you a massive return on investment because of the environment that it creates for the shoulder.
So in the lead up to the Sydney Olympics, there was a group of Olympic swimmers based in Leeds. And James Hickman was one of those, butterfly swimmer. And I can recall, it wasn't the Olympic trials, but it was one of the trials for a world championship, that James had hypermobile shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Lots of good swimmers do, right?
Yeah, but unfortunately, they occasionally popped out of joint. And I may be getting this story slightly twisted around with age and time. But my recollection is that as he was coming towards the wall, ready to touch, his shoulder popped out of joint. There was maybe one or two strokes left. He missed the stroke and missed the selection because that shoulder popped out. Most of the time he could control it, but just maybe thinking of finishing off the race rather than, you know, good technique, he just didn't quite get his body position right. But Terry, who was the coach, and I used to talk about this because Terry was one of the first coaches to employ somebody to come in and work specifically on the strength work. And he said to me, you can't get the arm to move faster through the water. You can't, you know, the speed which the hand can apply force against the water has a terminal limit. Mm-hmm. But we decided that you can improve the speed of the turn, the push off out of it. You can improve the explosion off the blocks. And most of all, that thing you talked about is like keep the money on the park. Is if they can turn up more frequently because the shoulders aren't hurting and they're more resilient, then it's the swimming where the magic works. The job of the guy in the, you know, in the background is to make sure that they can turn up for as many of those sessions as possible and complete them as required.
Yeah, and that's one thing. Like we had a massive win with a swimmer that I used to work with called Charlotte Henshaw. She's a double leg amputee. She's on the para canoe program now, but was on the swimming program for a long time. So she was a 100-meter breaststroker, and she's swimming without limbs from the knee down. So she's all upper body. And I've kind of wandered in there as a relatively young strength and conditioning coach and gone, well, that traditional periodization model looks like this. Let's do in a general prep phase, and then we'll do some more specific strength work, and we'll lift heavy, and then we'll do some power work to prep for the competition. And Charlotte, again, I will probably get some of these dates and timelines wrong, but she hadn't PB'd for years, like an extended period of time. And we did a full season and we hadn't really seen the performance improvements that we'd expected. So I sat her down at the beginning of the year and I said, when do you feel the best in the water? And she said, October, November. And I was like, well, that's when we do our general prep phase. That's when we're doing low load, high volume. We're kind of building the chassis to the engine, to the race car before we go and do our horsepower bits.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, let's just do that. Let's just do that for a whole year. Let's just do like pretty ugly high volume. So we're doing Ys, Ts, Ws, scaption, all the cuff work. And we were going 1 kilo for 20 reps. And we just like built a huge amount of endurance to the back of the shoulder. For the basically around a principle of if she can keep her elbow high in the catch position, then we're going to get a better connection with the water, which means we're going to generate more force. As soon as that elbow drops, which will happen when the posterior shoulder runs out of gas, then we're going to start to slip a little bit more, so we lose efficiency. She PB'd 3 times in about 6 weeks, like just literally boom, boom, boom. Just like it was unbelievable season. And yes, it's always multifaceted, right? There's not just me who's taking the credit for it, but there were some significant changes around how we changed her training program. And it was often endurance capacity for swimming, not how much force she could produce.
Yeah.
So my philosophy around swimming over the years is like get strong enough and then get stronger for longer. And we just used to build the program up to a certain point where they were competent or producing what we thought was enough force for them and for their sport or for their distance. And then we just used to stretch it more, just do it for longer, because then they can rock up and do the key sets or the bigger, longer volume sets. And we can maximize our performance adaptation because we can perform at a higher standard from a technical perspective for the duration. So we're just getting better gains. That's the job.
I don't know about you, Tim, but I wish I had a pound for every time somebody told me strength training doesn't help you be a faster runner or a faster swimmer. So why would I bother? You know, and I'm like you, it's going to build your resilience. It's going to help you turn up more often. It's going to help you be more consistent. It's going to help you keep your shape, whether that's your shape in the water or your shape as a runner, or even as a cyclist. It's going to help you keep your shape when everybody else is starting to lose their shape. And that's going to help you get a better performance.
Yeah.
But it's a slow burn, isn't it? Strength training. And, you know, you can feel like if you do a hard set of hundreds in the pool, you can walk away feeling, oh, that's been a good session. I'm going to get fitter from that. The work to make your body more resilient takes a lot longer. Yeah. And a lot of it's neuromuscular as well as just, you know, cardiovascular. So again, that's longer as well. So I feel like research doesn't point to being able to squat more or do more pull-ups leads you to be a faster swimmer. So then people think, well, why bother?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so many things that we used to do to kind of make it interesting for the guys, because swimming, if you're in a competitive swimming environment, it's a pretty mundane sport. Like the social side of it is difficult because you've got your face in the water most of the time. It's a grind, right? I mean, we've got people doing double sessions. They could be doing 8 a week or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like it's a lot of training at pretty unsociable hours. So the gym for me became an opportunity to make that sport a little bit, to add something that they would lose. And maybe that's me bringing my team sport environment or background into it and going, let's make the gym a fun environment. So we would have a very strong sense of athletic development. I'm in a Paralympic program, but I would, from the able-bodied swimming performance programs that I interacted with as well, you'd see the same thing, that swimmers aren't always the most athletic people because if they've got talent ID at a relatively young age, they spent a lot of time in the water, which means they might not have played sports like hockey and cricket and netball and football. So they haven't necessarily always developed the literacy from a physical perspective that comes with being in those sports.
Yeah.
So for example, I had a guy who was a decent national level swimmer, like, and you ask him to run up to the side of the pool, plant a foot and dive in, and he couldn't coordinate his feet to be able to execute that pattern for a number of different reasons, right? So when we got into with the swimming program, I was like, well, our gym program is an opportunity for me to make you more coachable, so that when you get on the deck and coach is looking at your starts and he's asking you to change a body position or a trajectory or an entry point, you understand where you are in space and how to manipulate your body so that you can technically execute better. And we would do that by things like handstands in the gym. So I brought a lot of the calisthenics stuff in because I was like, this is great for swimming. We've got high volume or high intensity work on the shoulder. Our first point of contact in a closed kinetic chain position, so the hand being fixed on the ground or on gymnastics rings or on a bar, we can really start to generate force around that, which is similar to what we're doing from a swimming perspective, even though it's not fixed. And I can teach you to start to learn to move in new ways. And that's where the top of my program, when I started with Ollie Hine and Charlotte Henshaw, was like, I had a section that just said athletic development. And each week or block, it was like, I'm going to teach you to move in a new way and do something you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys, because swimming can be quite, I say mundane, swimmers will be like, it's not Monday, I love it. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's the same, like a lot of the time, just the sets change. But they would come in, they all of a sudden had this new thing that they could learn and they loved it. And it made the strength and conditioning elements really like enjoyable for them, which gets better engagement. And then it's not going in there and doing what you think is strength training. If someone goes, strength training is boring, I would do the same thing as you and go, well, look at the potential performance improvement that you're leaving on the table. Your injury prevention, I mean, we can 100% be confident that, that strength training will decrease risk of injury if done well. Mm-hmm. And you can then start to just build in some other types of training program, which are going to be more fun for you to do. So find a way to make strength training fun. And that could be gymnastics types movements or calisthenics, or it doesn't have to be fighting for the bench press or the dumbbell racks.
Is I've had with strength coaches on the show, and I've spoken to a few now, we always come back to this general athlete's preparedness, which comes back to the sort of Eastern European dogma, doesn't it? Of and swimming and gymnastics were always early specialization sports for them, so they perhaps missed out on that. But for every other sport that an Eastern European athlete would do, there was always this general athleticism first before you got onto the specifics. And that general athleticism was the gymnastics, floor work, spatial awareness, technical skills with lifting. So no weights, but lifting a bar and being able to do an overhead squat and, you know, getting the timing right and then moving on to the more specific stuff. And I've, with all the strength coaches that are engaged in their profession, they've all read that history and understand that where all of that periodization stuff's come from. But for a lot of people that are reading the common press and picking up Men's Health, I think that's all missed out. So, you know, kettlebells are back in vogue now. I've been a great fan of kettlebells for a long time, but a lot of people don't understand why kettlebells are so good, because they don't have that background knowledge that, you know, Pavel Satsoulin talks about it, but most people miss that bit of his narrative.
Yeah. It's tools, right? And I think that's the thing where if you were to kind of simplify my philosophy down, that's what it's about. It's athleticism and physical literacy. So being able to swing a kettlebell and manage the variability of how the weight is going to move and to balance that with the chain and to offset. Like, so I use inverted kettlebell pressing a lot because it gives me so
much. Me too,
yeah. It's massive ticks in boxes from, it's one exercise which ticks about 5 boxes for me. But can you do that? And then can you hang? And can you crawl? And can you lift heavy? Like there is a place for putting a load of weight on a barbell and shifting it. For sure, that's still part of the program. But I think if I was to kind of look at that general preparation, I think that is in the most cases for most people, and it's different when you get into elite sport, but it's at least 70% of the job for most people. Because if you are engaged in those practices, you are by virtue of becoming more athletic and challenging yourself with different loads and intensities, going to start to develop better movement literacy and robustness. And yes, we can talk about making it sport specific, but for the general population, most people are so, because of, like, to your point of what life looks like day to day now, they move so poorly that there's so much on the table of just becoming more athletic and letting the transfer take care of itself rather than worrying about, is this sport specific?
Well, interestingly, I've spoken with quite a few top level running coaches. And more interestingly, none of them call themselves running coaches. They call themselves movement specialists, because their whole thing is, if I teach these folks to move better, they'll run better naturally anyway. Yeah. And the same with the top level swim coaches. You know, I can teach them to move better in the water and have that better spaced awareness to create less drag, be more efficient. They'll swim faster. Now then, you know, those swim coaches and run coaches also say, if you want to get better, you've got two ways. You can try and run harder and faster and longer, or same for swimming, or you can try and make yourself more efficient. And actually working to be more efficient through drills and the sort of stuff we're going to discuss is actually a lot easier on the body than just trying to go at it for harder and longer. So if you want longevity, the efficiency of movement way is by far the best option for just about everybody.
Yeah, and that's the bit that takes time, right? Like I've said from a youth development perspective, like, just if people are working in youth development, just get them guys to move well, because strength is easy. Like if I get an athlete comes through at 16 years old and they've got really good competency and kinesthetic awareness, they know where they are in space and they've got movement options, you can put a heavy bar on those guys and you can get them strong. It's just consistency at that point. Whereas you get somebody who comes through at 16 or 17 and can't move, they might miss their window at that point if they're on a performance program, because it takes us a long time to actually improve it, or they're just going to be radically talented that they don't need to move that well and they can still win. But there are those people that have got an opportunity that could be better prepared if they could move a little bit better.
Back to those young cricketers, I got really into what it was packaged to speed, agility, quickness. Do you remember that? You've probably seen that. And I remember going to watch a guy who came over. He was an ex NFL player called Randy Smythe, and he came and developed all this stuff. And I went to a workshop, and it was the rights to it in this country had been bought by a guy called Alan Pearson. And Alan was all like, this is a new coming. And I remember taking it back to a friend of mine who was an athletics coach in Leeds. And he went, oh, there's nothing different about that. We've been doing it since the 50s. It's like the Russians have been doing that. Just put all them paint sticks on the floor. You don't need one of them flash ladders. But I got all this. I took all these things to the cricketers, and I had these young kids. So a lot of them were going through puberty. So just at that point, gangly and awkward. But we had them doing hurdles, moving laterally, all sorts of footwork drills on the ladder, you know, the simple ones, and then crossing over and then getting them to concentrate on the ladder while catching a ball and throwing a ball and picking a ball up. And then we used to have these little, you know, the little speed balls with the knobbles on, so they would bounce all over the place. So we used to have them in a small-sided games, playing those and trying to catch it off on bounce. And Scott and myself used to watch them and think, God, these kids look awkward. But they're better than they were. And then we took them to a north of England academy week over at Lancashire Cricket Club. And there was all the other academies from Lancashire and Worcestershire and everywhere. And the Yorkshire lads moved so much better. You know, it wasn't until you saw them in comparison to the other kids that you realised just how much better they were at their movement skills and their athleticism. And I'm sure, because Johnny Bairstow and Joe Root were really keen on all this stuff. You know, you could tell, that's what you could tell about top people from a young age, isn't it? Their sort of diligence. I'm not claiming that credit for them, but I'm sure that stood them in good stead as they've got older.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think it ever could be time wasted on that sort of stuff.
No. And it's fun, like you say, it's fun for them as well, because it's something different than facing a bowling machine. Or getting hit on the hand again.
Yeah.
Nobody likes that. Wow. Okay. Well, we've already dived down a few rabbit holes and we haven't really got going, have we? So let's talk about the shoulder then, because you talked about the shoulder. I don't think you referred to it as a shoulder complex, but that's how I always talk about that whole grouping of muscles. And it's more than just how that ball sits in the socket. So if you can simply do this without diagrams and models, just explain about what the shoulder complex consists of and why it's more than just, you know, arm and deltoids.
Yeah, no worries. So we often kind of simplify the shoulder down. People do think, as you said, about the glenohumeral joint. So the humerus, the bone in your upper arm, sitting with the scapula or the shoulder blade. The shoulder complex is actually four joints. So we've got the glenohumeral joint, which everyone knows is the ball and socket. We've got the scapulothoracic. So that's the scapula sitting on the back of the rib cage. And then we've got our acromioclavicular and our sternoclavicular joints. So for what most people will know as a collarbone or the clavicle, at the side that sits on top of the shoulder, that's our acromioclavicular joint. And then the side or the insertion or the sort of joint, I should say, is the clavicle with a sternum on the rib cage is going to be our sternoclavicular joint. It's the articulation of those four joints which allows the shoulder to move. Now, the collarbone is essentially a strut which allows the arm to be suspended slightly away from the midline of the body. So it creates this the structural support essentially for it. And then it's a combination of the joints working together, particularly around the glenohumeral joint and the scapulothoracic joint, which is going to create the mobility and movement for the shoulder and give it all those movement options that it has. Now, the challenge that comes in is because the glenohumeral joint particularly, and let's say the scapulothoracic, because it's what we would call as a false joint, essentially it's suspended in space by muscle forces. There's no joint capsules or anything. It just kind of sits on the back of the rib cage. But they have a massive amount of movement options, and that's because the joint is designed for mobility. So if we take our glenohumeral joint, the humeral head is three times bigger, there or thereabouts, than the socket that it sits on the scapula. So whereas if you take the hip, I use this comparison all the time, if you take the hip, we've got the head of the femur, which sits into the acetabulum on the pelvis, the socket, and it's pretty much kind of surrounded by it. There's a really good contact surface there, and we've got lots of strong ligaments around it. We've got a strong joint capsule. We've got lots of big muscles around it. That thing shouldn't come out of place. So most people don't know anybody who's dislocated a hip, but there'll be lots of people who know they've dislocated a shoulder. Mm-hmm. I am probably in a small group of people who's done both. So I dislocated my hip when I was 11, which was another rugby accident. I should have given up at that point. But the shoulder then has this you have to have all that mobility to be able to do the job that it needs to be able to do. But because we have the mobility, we can't have stability at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you can't have a super stable and a super mobile joint together. So because of that, because of the job that the shoulder has, as I mentioned before, it's effectively massively governed by neuromuscular control, because, and that effectively means all of the muscles around the shoulder working together to control position. And if you think about, I'll try and do this bit simply, if that humeral head is three times bigger than the socket that it sits on, that scapula is going to move as the shoulder or the humerus starts to move, which allows us to get into overhead positions. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a really beautifully designed piece of physiology, really, because as the humeral head starts to roll in the socket, if the scapula is going to come with it, that humeral head also needs to roll and glide down into the socket. Otherwise, it would just roll up off the top of the joint. Mm. So we've got quite an intricate and quite precise level of movement control happening all the time. And now I've explained the detail of it, which I hope has resonated or landed with people. Now think about, I don't know, I've seen a video where you've got a guy playing baseball and he catches the ball at the perimeter and he can launch that thing however far that distance is to the home plate or back to the catcher with pinpoint accuracy. Like that, if you think about what the shoulder is capable of doing based on then the mechanics of how it works, it's actually pretty phenomenal to think about. So the reason, therefore, why we maybe, and to the point of maybe before around what the shoulder needs from a training perspective, if we don't have that neuromuscular control, that organization, coordination, and this higher quality movement of all the joints and then the muscles acting on the shoulder, then we get less than ideal. And people get a bit funny about the word optimal now with the shoulder, because there is no optimal. Mm. But we need high quality movement for the shoulder to be able to move well, pain-free, and under the demands it's going to place upon it. If you want me to go back over any of that, because it's not the easiest thing to explain to people listening on an audio.
No, it's not. I bet you've got somewhere you've got a video describing all this with on your YouTube channel, haven't you? Maybe we can get a link to that, and then if folks are really interested in it, they can go there and get that little sort of educational with the aid of a diagram or your little shoulder model.
Yeah, sometimes it's worth seeing. If you look at a shoulder from a skeletal perspective, even just Googling the humeral joint into get an image of it, you'll see how big that humeral head is in comparison to the socket. And then you think, well, that thing needs to stay on the socket for the shoulder to work. When it doesn't stay in the socket, we have a dislocation, and that's obviously pretty traumatic. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's 17 muscles that attach into the scapula. So you've got that. Eric Cressy talks about this as quite a nice example of being, imagine the scapula like a piece of tent canvas. We've got guy ropes pulling in all different directions. If we've got some of those guy ropes which are too tight or too loose, we're going to, that the canvas gets distorted, and therefore, in this case, the shoulder, that quality of movement isn't going to be as good as it could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody once described to me the shoulder joint being like a bowling ball resting on a plate, and what really holds it in place, it's sort of loosely nestles there, but then it's just all the tendons and ligaments, and there's a lot of nerves as well, isn't there, around the shoulder? So if anything's slightly out of joint, that can cause you to get that shoulder pain that isn't necessarily a dislocation or a pulled muscle. It's just a little bit of a nerve impingement, mainly maybe to do with weak posterior strength, because you sit with your shoulders hunched all day with your arm out on it and raised working on a mouse.
Yeah. The shoulder, we sometimes talk about high performance. You've actually used this when the conversation is funny when you said when we were chatting before, but the high performing shoulder, in terms of a shoulder which is able to withstand the demands we want to place upon it, a high performing shoulder will need balance of strength and forces. And strength is a massive part of what we will look at from a rehabilitation or reconditioning component. Mm-hmm. If we haven't got strength balance, if we've got something which isn't that strong in comparison, it's almost that strength balance around the shoulder which leads to the problems, because without going down a rabbit hole, it's very difficult to look at how a shoulder movement goes, that's the problem, because we've got so much variability there. Mm-hmm. We actually just need to you can't go, it's that muscle which does that, which there's lots of, it's more of a coordination. So the example we sometimes use is around like an orchestra. So you need all the sections of that orchestra to play well together. If you've got one section which is playing louder, faster, more aggressively than everything else, the whole thing falls apart. So we need that stability, mobility, strength, the muscle forces and contribution to movement to be well organized. And that sounds like a lot. And you go, well, how do you do all of those things? And that comes back to what we're talking about before from a human movement perspective, is if we just move more, and in more different ways, and given how the shoulder is designed in terms of the positions that it can move into, if we do more of that, then most of the time, and if we're not consistently repeating the same pattern, we're going to keep the shoulder pretty healthy. The problem is often going to come when we do the same thing repeatedly, the same plane of motion, and we don't then counteract that with other things. But most human movement, if it's done well from a physical preparation perspective, will be fairly balanced. And that, from people who haven't got a shoulder problem now, is actually going to stand them in pretty good stead.
Yeah, you were talking about your the inverted kettlebell press. One of my favorite kettlebell exercises is the Turkish get-up.
Yeah.
Because there are so many components to that. But have you heard of Tom Morrison? Tom was a guest on the show a few months back, and he talked about inverted press. But he said, try doing a Turkish get-up with an inverted kettlebell hold as well, because that really challenges your spatial awareness and balance.
Yeah.
It's not just wrist strength, is it? If your shoulder goes at all out of point, everything falls off.
Yeah, and from a coaching perspective, like, I would talk about that as a constraint, or we dive into dynamic systems theory and we go, well, actually, we're just changing the task. And that's exactly what I mean. So if we, in that dynamic systems theory, we have the organism or the athlete, let's put that person there, the task and the environment. If we can change one of those two things, the task or the environment, and then let the organism or the athlete find a solution to it. So if we take an inverted kettlebell press, the brain has got a task now, it's got a job to do, which is don't lose that kettlebell balance. So rather than being, oh, this is very much about, we need to fire the external rotators, like, that will happen if we squeeze a kettlebell and we allow the brain to kind of work out what's going to happen or how to produce that pattern of movement. And that's more about where ultimately we want to get people to from a shoulder perspective, is just thinking about what are these small things that you can put in. It might be that someone just picks up a inverted kettlebell Turkish get-up and that's their shoulder exercise. And it might be for a lot of people that they don't need to be doing lengthy shoulder-based preparation work if they're not coming at this from an injured state. And that's one of the reasons back to why I use gymnastics rings a lot. Because if we take a gymnastics ring push-up, for example, so we're just doing normal push-ups on the rings, because we have now this instability, we have the stimulus for the dynamic stability that the shoulder needs based on the fact that we don't have this massive amount of structural integrity in the shape of ligaments and high levels of joint security, if you want to call it that, or structure. So with the gymnastics rings, with the rings moving slightly, we can choose to either stay close to the rings, so we keep the straps against the side of the body, or you can move yourself into a position where the hands move relatively freely and you have to then create the stability by yourself. Mm-hmm. Also, because we're in a position where if you don't control that eccentric phase or lowering down towards the floor, you're just going to hit your face on the ground or you're going to fall. So the environment now forces us to work through a slightly slower range of motion. The chain is working because the core is now having to work to support the body because we aren't lying on a bench pressing dumbbells anymore. So we're starting to go with just one piece of equipment. I still get the chest strength that I'm looking for, but I'm doing it in a way which is respecting the design of the shoulder from a stability perspective, and I get the kinetic chain, and I can move the shoulders through range of motion, and the scapulars aren't pinned down against the bench, so that can move. If you wind that all the way back to what I said at the beginning around what the physiotherapists are trying to do from a rehabilitation perspective, is they want range of motion, control, effectively, and kinetic chain integration. We're doing the same thing, but now it's an exercise which I could put a weight vest on and scale it to a 5-repetition max if I wanted to. But it's ticking all of the boxes along the way of giving the things that the shoulder likes in order to perform well.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. In terms of some of the other things that we have to overcome as strength coaches, again, it's the popular press about, you know, 5x5. Building maximal strength, feeling the burn and the pump, because in terms of fatigue from something like that that's challenging your neuromuscular system, that's probably going to fatigue first before your muscles do when you're doing gymnastic ring press-ups. And so a lot of people walk away from that workout thinking, well, I don't feel anything. How can that be beneficial? But again, if you want a strong framework that's robust and allows you to turn up regularly for your program, maybe the hypertrophy aspect and the burn and the muscular fatigue isn't necessarily what you want to be aiming your program at, but it's still difficult to overcome the sort of, you know, the popular press and, well, some of the nonsense that you see on social media and on the Instagram pages.
Well, if people are skeptical about it, I would encourage them to try it, because it's like a lot of people that I would give this to, they're like my, they will come off and go, my chest feels like incredible. Because there's so many benefits in there, but if this is my challenge to people, listen, if you go on the gymnastics rings and you walk away from it and cast it aside as an exercise, which you don't think is very good because you're not very good at it, that speaks a lot into where you're at from a physical preparation perspective.
Yeah.
You haven't earned the right, because I can load, I'm pointing because they're just there, but if I can load up my gymnastics rings work and start to not lean on the straps and I say work into higher intensities, which it's not, I'm not saying don't do heavy dumbbell presses and bench presses and other barbell based movements. What I'm saying is, as we, to your point before, around that general preparation phase, let's have some of this stuff in the program, because it's building a chassis which you can then put bigger engines in if you need to be able to do that for your sport.
Well, I talked about, I mentioned Pavel Satsulin and all of his Russian kettlebell stuff. One of the things he talks about when you're doing overhead lifts is making sure that you can suck the arm on the shoulder down into the socket to really get that sort of strength coming from the just the fixating there. Is there some substance to that, or is that just Pavel's theories and ideas coming to the fore?
So I've asked this question so many times around like weightlifting. When you're overhead, do I want to be high, do I want to be low, or do I want to be somewhere in between?
Yeah.
I'm going to wind back a little bit. If you have been told previously that you need to squeeze everything back and down, so shoulders back and down, you are, and even when you're pressing overhead, you've been miscued. And I'm guilty of this. I used to do this before I knew better. When we go overhead, we need the scapula to go up and around the ribcage. So if you're pulling tension to try and stop the scapula from moving and squeezing back and down, you are stopping the shoulder from going in the position that it needs to get into in order to execute a good overhead pressing pattern. So this then answers the question, I think, comes down to depending on intensity. So how you bench heavy or how I horizontal row heavy will be potentially different to what I do if I'm doing a set of 8 to 12 versus a 3 to 5. So pressing overhead and I'm going heavy overhead, and I'm probably going to go and try and find a reasonable amount of stability in that position. I'm not going to be wanting to move my shoulder around overhead under a heavy load. Whereas if I was to go for a lighter load and I'm going to press overhead, then maybe I've got a little bit more freedom to think about how I'm moving that shoulder. So I always talk about, like, I want options with people. I want you to know how to lift heavy, and I want you to know how to lift for long or for higher volumes. And then you choose the strategy which you are going to use based on the task which we are trying to execute. So you bent over row is a great example, right? If I'm doing a horizontal row for volume, I want that shoulder to reach. I want to get the scap around the rib cage, and I want to actually protract and start the movement from there. Now, if I'm going to go for a 3 rep max row, I'm not going to start in that reach position. I'm probably going to crank back. I'm going to hold a reasonable amount of tension between my shoulder blades, and then I'm going to pull and row.
Okay. So do you, you know, when you're doing those rows, do you, you're talking about protraction where you let the shoulder blades separate and almost let the shoulder joint visibly fall forwards? Are you then trying to do the reverse of that as you get into the top of the movement, particularly if you're using dumbbells? Are you trying to get some retraction in the shoulder blades as well?
Yeah, exactly that. And think about essentially that scapula. Because of, again, going back to what I've tried to explain in a succinct manner around how the shoulder is designed, that scapula needs to move. When people run into problems with shoulders, it's often because that scapula can't move. So the opportunity when we're doing things like rowing-based patterns is to start with a reach, allows me to get the shoulder around the ribcage into a protracted position. And then as I row, rather than trying to initiate that row and go, right, now I'm going to squeeze it, fix it, and then pull, I'm going to reach, and I'm going to allow the whole thing to come together. So I want scapula and shoulder and elbow to move as a complex.
Okay. So if we were doing a press up, which is effectively the reverse of that movement. Are you going for scapular protraction at the top of the press, and are you allowing the scapula to retract as you lower yourself down towards the floor? So you're controlling that shoulder blade movement as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's like the rings is a great example of that, because you can push and reach at the top. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if people have been cued back and down, and when we look at their shoulders, they're very dominant into rhomboids and mid-traps. So everything's pulling the scapula towards the spine when we need it to go around the ribcage. Mm-hmm. I'll often give them more what we like kind of call reaching and rounding-based work. So going into a ring push-up and pressing out and then getting to really drive the scaps around the ribcage. Mm. I'll even cue a little external rotation because I can on the rings, and then letting them come back. And we want the shoulders to come back for those watching this, if it's on video, we'll open that shoulder up. Mm. We don't want the shoulder staying forward, so we need that whole complex to come back. Mm. And it's the fluidity of the movement of the scapula around the rib cage and having the option for it to be able to do that, which is way more valuable from a shoulder performance perspective than fixing it in a set position, just moving the elbow effectively. Mm. Which is what a lot of people will tend to do.
Mm. Do you I asked one of the questions I was asking you whether we could discuss is the common butts, the common myths that we need to bust around the way people train their shoulders.
Yes.
Typically in the gym, I see people doing shrugs to improve the size of the traps and upright rows. I see people bench pressing until the bar's touching the chest. Mm-hmm. With a heavy weight. And I've always thought, that point there, are you using your pecs really getting what you want? Or are you really just putting too much stress on you? The anterior part of your shoulder. I see people doing lateral raises, and I think, well, why don't you just lift a heavy weight overhead and get some, lateral raise using more load? What are the problems that you see with the way most people are working their shoulders in the gym? Other than what we've already talked about, is they're not doing the prep work.
Yeah. So I think I'm in the camp of there's no bad movements if you've earned the right to be able to do them. Mm-hmm. So there'd be a whole conversation around dips. Should people do dips? I'm like, I'm fine with dips, providing you have the range of motion to be able to get into shoulder extension and keep the humeral head in a good position. So even like upright rows is a fairly controversial one, but if you can do upright rows pain-free, then do upright rows. A lot of our training methodology today of what you see in the general gym is bodybuilding orientated. Mm. So people will be doing lat raises before bigger medial deltoids because they want to look a certain way, which is fine. If that's what they care about, that's a pretty good way to get bigger medial deltoids. So I think differentiating between, or let's say to answer the question, identifying what it is that you want and then gearing your training program around that. So if someone's looking for more of a performance athletic type outcome from their strength training like a bodybuilder is not the right way to go, because it's not going to give you that. It's going to get you bigger, but not going to give you the athletic outcomes that you're looking for. Equally like with the chest press, like if you can get the bar to the chest because you've got the range of motion, you've got the shoulder stability to be able to do it, and you can press heavy, then you can do it. But it's more about how we are preparing the shoulder for that. So have we got mobility and stability to be able to couple with that? And I think the big problem that people are having, if we take out any particular movement, is that we are great at scaling strength. We might have barbell weights going up by 10, 15, 20, 30% over time. But what are we doing to scale the stability components to be able to handle those forces? Now, to a point, just by lifting those heavier weights, we're going to scale the stability system because we have to. But we see so many people that are just weak or undertrained or detrained, let's kind of say, around some of that stabilization musculature, which means that the bigger patterns break down or they start to cause problems because they will come in, for example, and I do a lot of work in CrossFit and these guys are strong, so they can press overhead, but we come in and we've not got really, if you look at, like, if you normalize it to body weight, The strength of the rotator cuff, for example, is way, way down on where it should be. Mm. And it's that kind of stuff of going, if you're not going to train with an athletic outcome and doing some of the stuff that we've already talked about, and you also want to lift heavy and do lots of barbell-based sagittal plane work in fixed kind of patterns and planes, and you're not doing some kind of shoulder work to prepare the shoulder for the demands you want to place upon it, based on the fact that it requires and depends on that muscle balance of forces or force generation capacity of all that musculature around the shoulder to be able to work effectively, you're not training the shoulder with and respecting the way that it's designed. You're training the shoulder like the hip, and you can't just the two aren't the same. Like, I think I look back and go, where did our 5x5 come from? Or we probably looked at deadlifts and squats. And now you go to any conference and you'll hear people talk about deadlifts, squats, and hinges. So few people talk about the shoulder. But what I think we've done is we've gone, well, 5x5 or whatever you want to roll rep range, maximum strength, gets the hip pretty strong. Let's do 5x5 for the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're working with, you say it's a ball and socket joint, but it's two very different ball and socket joints. Mm. You can't just load that shoulder with maximum strength work for 5 reps and 5 sets and expect it to be fine over time, because it won't be. I'm confident about that. I haven't seen what happens.
Mm. Let's go back to modern living, because, you know, when people first start coming into the gym, if they are, and let's face it, most physios will tell people, oh, the reason why you've got this is because these are weak. You haven't got enough strength. You haven't got enough control here. How much does modern living and the fact that we sit down a lot and we're looking at computers and everything's in front of us and we've got a phone to our ear, got a shoulder one side of our torso tensed up to hold a phone to our ear, we've got an arm lifted for a mouse, we're probably driving along with one arm resting on the window and the other hand holding a coffee cup, you know, everything's off balance. How much of that you have to unpick first when you get people into the gym with shoulder problems?
So it's my favorite ones is, so we do a lot of CrossFit. So we will have people that sit at a desk or in a car for 8 to 10 hours a day. And then they're in a rush to get to the box and they rock up and they're going to do the 6 p.m. workout. And it's got some kipping patterns in it. And we've done nothing but sit in thoracic flexion or spinal flexion. So I've sat slumped over my phone or my computer or my desk or whatever. And then all of a sudden I want to aggressively move into extension. And then we wonder why we have a problem. Yeah. Your body adapts to the stress you place upon it, right? It's the age-old strength and conditioning principle. And the brain's role in that is it's saying, well, the brain's interested in survival and equilibrium. So it doesn't really like being stressed. It kind of likes to sit at a steady state. So if we place the brain in an environment where we sit all day, the brain is going to go, to make this easier, I'm going to adapt in a way which gets me better at sitting. So it will start to create the physiological adaptations to make you better at sitting, because that's what it needs to be able to do to survive in the environment that you've placed it in. The brain doesn't know that you want to go to the CrossFit class or you want to go and swim or do whatever it is later on that day for the 45 minutes to an hour that you want to do it when you're spending 12 hours sat in a sedentary position. So movement and setting up a lifestyle which enables us to move more throughout the day and be less sedentary, I think, is huge. I think it's very difficult to quantify exactly how those impact shoulder health and performance. But if it would be daft to kind of think that sitting in front of a laptop with a poor positioning for extended periods of time, not just for a week, but for like years on end, doesn't have something to do with the shoulder problems that we see. And it also then, if you think about what people want to be able to do, like go and throw a cricket ball at the weekend or swim a certain distance or whatever, mm-hmm. we spend all week training the shoulder to do one thing, which is to sit. And then now all of a sudden when we decide it's the right time to go and do it, weather's nice or whatever, we're going to go and do this thing. And we get a bit frustrated because body breaks down on us. And why has that happened? You know, well, you don't move enough.
I used to do some work with Mick Hill, the javelin thrower. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's an activity that puts a lot of stress on hips, everything, you know, lateral movement, explosiveness, rotating, sort of flexing your back, twisting your back. He pulled a hamstring in training. Yeah, I mean, he said, do you know what the problem here, Si? I've been on a long drive today. I've been unathletic all day. I need a different warm-up when I've been unathletic versus my normal job. And he'd just gone into it, some of his running drills, far too quickly. And, you know, it wasn't a throwing problem. We hadn't even got to the throwing bit yet. It was the prep for the throwing. Yeah. But it sidelined him and he missed a couple of competitions because of that. And I thought that was really poignant and just probably points to the fact that athletes like that at the top level have just a better awareness of everything. He's, you know, recognising that he'd been unathletic today and then going too quickly into his normal routine, needed to have a different warm-up routine if he'd been sitting down all day versus, you know, out coaching and moving.
Yeah, and we kind of started the conversation of this subject around like what postural positions we find ourselves into. But I think the other thing that I see a lot of with the population that I work with now is a disregard for external stresses in their life. Mm-hmm. So sleep, quality of it, duration, what our nutrition's like, stress levels, relationships, connection, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But we still want to train like we're 25 years old. Like I'm 43 years old. So as you get older, the most important thing that you can do is learn to listen to your body and know when is a time to push. So you come down in the morning and sometimes you go, you warm up, you go, you know what, I'm sluggish today. It's Monday morning. Like, we did some heavy power cleans today. So I'm like, I'm sluggish. I'm going to start easy and I'm going to see what my body tells me when I get into the session. Mm-hmm. Body actually, when I warmed up, was okay. So we got a decent session up. But there's equally times I come down and be like, I don't feel like this is going great today. So rather than thinking I have to nail this session, I need to hit these weights or these distances, you're better off slightly modifying that session, maybe doing something else for that day and then coming back to it another time so that you don't end up tipping the balance against you and then picking up an injury, which you then are going to spend 3 months rehabilitating for the sake of one session. It's not worth it.
That reminds me of something that we teach in British Triathlon. So when you come to do your presentation, we might touch on this, is the biopsychosocial, which is a phrase that's becoming a little bit more well-known now. And it's the, you know, most coaches, less experienced, less knowledgeable coaches will focus on the biology, you know, and a particular element of the biology, but they forget about those external stresses, not just the ones that are around them, like the environment, you know, your work, what you eat, but also those internal stresses in somebody's head and what worries they've got. And all of those things, really important. I mean, are you wearing an Aura ring there? Did I see you wearing an
Aura ring? Just a silicon one.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, the Aura rings and the Whoop are becoming more and more popular, and they do give you a real nice insight. Having worn a Whoop for several years, I'm not sure still how accurate the data is, but in terms of behavioral change and point and using it to sort of test certain things, I think they could be quite a good tool. So I think folks are starting to get more of a sense of those external things, whether they've still got round to the point of reacting by adjusting the training is another thing. Some people have.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate, I guess, in that sense that we've been doing this for a long time. So you get to understand, like, I don't need a heart rate monitor to tell me how hard I'm working because I know. But I think more data is good to a point if you're going to do something constructive with it. Otherwise, in sports science, we would always kind of like be dismissive of collecting data if we're not going to do it or do anything with it. We're just tracking for the sake of tracking. Athletes don't like it if you don't do something with all the data you're making them input. In the same way, I think if you wake up and your sleep score is down and you feel down, and when you warm up, you don't feel great, then you modify it. But equally, as you say, that data, if you probably pull the lid up on it or the hood up, you go, accuracy, questionable. But if it helps you to give you an insight into how your body is, what your data is telling you, does that match with how I'm feeling? Because equally, sometimes if you're in a performance environment, you need to push sometimes, and it might not be always the perfect time to do it, but it's knowing how often to do it. And then if you are going to do it that day, what are you going to do tomorrow or later on? Because you can't do that every day for the next week.
Inigo San Milan, who's the coach for Tadej Pogacar, made a good point because somebody asked him about this, you know, do you test for HRV? Do you take those metrics every day? And he said, we do, but we don't let Tadej see them because if he's got a key stage in the tour and his recovery scores are in the red, who wants to see that just as you're about to start a time trial? But equally, when he's looked at them afterwards, he said, I felt brilliant today. And he's destroyed the stage and left everybody 5 minutes behind. And then on another day, he's couldn't stay with the break and he's got a green recovery score. So there's definitely an anomaly there. And, you know, that whole point about what do your recovery scores say, most Tour de France riders are being the red from the third or fourth day, weren't they? With the amount of, you know, the weather and the, you know, the food and the stress and everything. So at that point, it's who performs best with fatigue, I suppose.
Yeah. And it's using intelligence. Let's be honest, like with those kind of athletes, the job of the sports science and performance team is to remove all the other stresses in their life. So you've only got this one thing to think about. Whereas for anybody who's not a professional athlete, we've got 20 other things going on a day-to-day basis, potentially. Yeah. And I've seen it in James Clear blog originally. I don't know where the source comes from, but the four burners theory, where you can only have like a couple of those burners turned up. So you've got like physical training, family, social life, and career. And you can't have all four of those up at the same time. But if you're getting, what I've often found is if you are, and I'm guilty of this as well, is if you are a type A person and you've been athletic since a young age, you then come into your late 30s and 40s and you bring that mindset in. So you are type A in all of those things. I want to be the best father to my kids, the best husband, and I'm pushing my career and I want to smash my training. It's a tough ask. Some sooner or later, one of those things will have to give if you're going to actually excel in the others.
I think we used to do a lot of our triathlon teaching at Loughborough. And I know the students there would always say, you know, that there are three S's, sport, social, and study. But you can only really excel at two of them. So if you want to be in the rugby team and you want to be out drinking, your degree is probably going to suffer.
Yeah, that's fair.
So probably very, very similar to what you've just talked about there. One of the blogs that I read, and I'm going to signpost some of these blogs because you've got some excellent stuff on your website. You talk about ground-based exercises, and we've talked about some of those today. We talked about the Turkish get-up. We talked about bear crawls and some of those animal flow movements. But you talk about why ground-based exercises can be so beneficial. But they're, for most people, they're largely ignored, aren't they? As a human function activity as well as an athletic performance activity.
Yeah, so in that kind of under that banner, I'm talking about crawling based movements. So getting on your hands and your feet and moving around. Some people don't want to do it because it looks funny in the gym. What I would say to you is I've looked funny in the gym for the last 15 years because I'm constantly training in a different way, and the general standard and type of training that people will be doing in your general gym is coming from relatively, let's say, surface level information. So if you look a bit different in the gym, you're probably doing something to a point, and I probably should caveat that, but there's a lot of times it will actually probably be the right thing for you. So you're getting over that social etiquette of going, I'm actually going to do a bear crawl or a crab walk in the gym, is actually going to be really positive for you. They are a really good way from, you can use ground-based movements in a number of different ways. Youth development is brilliant because you're getting kids moving, you're developing physical literacy. I use them all the time in shoulder reconditioning because it's often the starting point where I'll get people to go for a high hip bear crawl. So their hands and knees, they're on their hands and the feet. Hips are quite high so that we're into a slightly kind of more shoulder flexion position. But the nature of the closed kinetic chain pattern whereby the hand being fixed on the floor creates some really favorable conditions for the shoulder from a stability, proprioception, co-contraction perspective. So we're doing some really good stuff there. We're also connecting the chain. So we've got the rest of the body is integrating and moving through. We can move in different ways and different patterns and different directions. We can add or create stability challenge. So you might pause with one hand and foot off the ground. And can we now connect these kind of movements together? The big one that people struggle with is a crab walk. So you remember, like, you used to go when you were kids to play crab football. So like hands behind your back, hips towards the ground and chest facing up, like scuttling around like little beetles on the floor. Like, people get into their 20s, 30s and 40s and you ask them to crab walk and they've got zero coordination to be able to do it. And part of that from a shoulder perspective is we just don't have this shoulder extension pattern anymore. So we can't link this chain together. So from a coordinative perspective, they are like really effective exercises to get people moving better.
What was really significant for me when I broke my collarbone is I had to have 5 weeks in a sling and then another 9 weeks of just letting the bone callus form before I could really do anything with this. So it's three and a half months really without anything on here. So a complete loss of strength, coordination, even doing a 4-point kneeling and just touching my left arm to my right shoulder left me so wobbly on this right arm. I was really shaking just to stabilize myself. That was without any other movement. And I was quite shocked about how much coordination and stability and strength I'd lost there. It came back very quickly, but having never had an injury of that length before, it was quite shocking.
Yeah,
just the difference. And I guess unless you've had that, you don't realize how much strength and stability you have around your shoulder.
Yeah, and that's to your point before, and that's the neuromuscular components of just actually exposing the brain back into an environment where we can start to get some stimulus and adaptation to those types of things. And like I'll use ground-based movement as a progression to other things. So it's my onboarding piece, really, because it's pretty accessible and the risk is really low. Mm. So that might then become hand balancing skills. So rather than bear crawls, we're then going to go into frog stands where I'm going to basically reduce the base of support and have people balancing on their hands. We might go to wall walks. So I'm starting to really get some nice single arms stabilities. I'm walking myself up the wall in a controlled way. And that might also then go the other way down a performance route of being a good onboarding point for plyometric drills. So one of the drills we'll use to your point about that single arm balance position would be to have people on some blocks or parallel bars or something, maybe like, I don't know, foot off the ground. And then they'll just drop off that, but catch on a single arm. So can I then just decrease and stabilize myself in a bit more of a dynamic explosive or coming down from more of a dynamic type movement pattern? So there's lots of different things there, but I using the ground and essentially the a closed kinetic chain environment. So that will be ground, hanging, or TRX or suspension trays or something, rings, whatever. They're so good for the shoulder. I would always recommend that somebody has some component of that sort of stuff in their program. And it could be that you just get into hanging. Can you single arm hang like for 10 seconds? And can you do that multiple times? If you've got a functional rig in your gym and you've got monkey bars, can you traverse and travel and move around on those and start to play around those things? Because you could when you were 10, but you can't when you're 40. I mean, what does that say about how well you've managed your physical development over the years?
Well, and going past 40, how does that say that you've managed your physical decline over the years, if anything? You know, because for all of us, we are going to get old, and perhaps, you know, there's a lot of people at your age that perhaps aren't, but I call it the physical pension. You know, you pay into a fiscal pension because you'd like something nice to be able to draw on when you get to 65. Well, I'd like a nice physical pension to be able to draw on when I get to 65 as well. My father passed away last year. The reason he ended up in hospital was because he couldn't get off the sofa, ended up on the floor, and was there for a day or two before somebody called for help. And that's just a lack of strength and coordination in his upper body to get off the floor. So, you know, a physical function. Like we talked about hip strength and stability. One of the things I remember from my early years as a fitness trainer was that sometimes you can't prevent osteoporosis and you certainly can't reverse it. But if you can stop people falling over, then at least that's part of partly successful. A bigger success story. I had a call with a strength coach from America who brought on one of what he calls his silverbacks. This guy's 73. He's a retired dentist. Him and Matt have been working together for 20 years. And he was proudly telling me that he can do 7 pull-ups on gymnastics rings. Now, the gymnastics rings are looped over a bar. They're not hanging from ropes, but there's still a large element of stability there. And he can hang for a minute. He can do 7 pull-ups, each of them with a scapular pull-up first before he goes into it and control it. And he's doing that at 73. When he was 60, he couldn't do any. So he's actually been getting stronger every year as there's that sort of natural and generally expected decline. So I was really impressed with all that, because when he showed me some of the powder skiing stuff that he was doing, because this guy's an avid powder skier at 73, you know, they had some incredible squats on his tiptoes with a goblet squats on his tiptoes, balancing on a Bosu ball, you know, walking on tiptoes down a straight line and being able to walk on the line and hold it and then go backwards as well. You know, some great stuff.
Yeah, I think that we should take that stuff as inspiring. I think I'm like an anomaly in my peer group of the people that I went to university with. They're most kind of like, guys, stop training, stop playing rugby, carry on drinking, and they get the body as a result. But I mean, if there is one thing as I'm getting older, that you start to realize is the most important thing that keeps you out of pain, it is strength. And we're biased because we're strength coaches, but it is actually the most powerful thing that you can do to offset any kind of aging, because as soon as you lose function and your ability to be able to move, then life is going to get pretty miserable. And I love the story that you told there, because let's not kind of try and kid ourselves that 73-year-old is genetically gifted to be able to move like that at that age. Like, he's just put the work in probably from 60 onwards. But we've used the same term over the years as well around physical pensions, like investing now, because it's too late to start Well, let's say it's not too late. I mean, what do you say around financial investing? Is that the best time to start was 20 years ago? The second best time to start is today. But I think if people are, and we're probably listening to talking to a biased audience because they listen to a physical type sport based podcast. But for those in our communities and our families that aren't active in training, like it's, I think that's probably the biggest thing that we can just encourage people to stay strong.
The another coach I was talking to who's in his 70s was telling me that we were talking about strength training and what he does, what I do. And we got to talking about overhead lifts. And he said, actually, I was reminded the other week that I need to do that because I was getting off a plane and I was lifting my bag out of the overhead thing. And it was on the limit and awkward. And I nearly dropped it on the head of the person who was sitting there because I didn't have the strength and control that we've talked about earlier to be able to pick that out and then lower it down at a position of, you know, extension away from me and control it so I didn't land it on that person's head. Now, this is for me as well. As you get older, it's not just can you maintain your sporting activity, which for those of us who like sport is important, but for everybody, including those athletes, we're humans before we're athletes. And so human function is critical to enjoy, to maintain enjoyment of life.
Yeah, I've got two young kids. I mean, people, we actually waited quite a long time to have kids, but there'll be people listening to this that are probably younger than me and they've got older kids potentially, but mine are 7 and 3. I think of people that have had shoulder issues in the past, like dislocations or whatever, played would be like, there is nothing my kids like more than being thrown around in the swimming pool, like properly thrown away. So I'm the guy in the middle of the swimming pool, everyone's watching on going, is that safe? But I'm like push pressing. I remember we went on a holiday to a few years ago, like with my little boy Jack at the time, and he was probably about three or 4 years old, but I'm like launching him, but then having the confidence to be able to throw him and catch him. And I've got two shoulder reconstructions, right? So I just think that sort of stuff, and it's those memories and the connection that you can make. I guess I'm now kind of the conversations around what are you doing to enhance your lifestyle, and training is not just around athletic performance.
Yeah.
But what else does it look like? Because you're dead right. I mean, those are the things that I remember when the days come when I can't do them anymore.
The majority of our listeners are triathletes. One of the things that I've often talked with triathletes about their swimming is that if they don't have that stability around the shoulder blade and also the muscular endurance, once they get tired, if the shoulder, you know, the muscles that control the scapula stop functioning as well, then the ball will no longer remain as well positioned in the sock as it can. So as you're facing downwards in the water, that lever length is a bit longer, but you don't have the same, you know, control over internal and external resistance. So the ability to hold your stroke when you're faced with the resistance of the water is reduced. And so it is more likely that you'll turn your thumbs up and you'll start to slip the water and then you'll be trying harder, but swimming slower. And so we talk about how to improve performance, actually, rather than back to that whole thing about rather than swimming more or swimming harder, just get more control around the scapula. Triathletes again, I like those endurance athletes. Why do I need to do strength training? If there were some simple exercises that triathletes can do for their shoulders that will help improve all three disciplines, what would you be pointing them towards? Because the time limitations are the big excuse for why they don't do it.
Yeah, so you go down one of two routes with this one, I think. Either, and we've talked about them both today, if you are the sort of person who can get on board with lower level, low intensity exercises, using resistance bands. I mean, they've come on a long way since we used to have those, like, you get those 1 meter cut off strips of TheraBand. Like, you can now get proper handles and stuff, and they're super cheap. If you could build some stuff into your training week, I would have people doing, and it's three exercises, just go through something like some external rotator cuff work, because if you're doing a lot of freestyle swimming, we're probably going to benefit from some more posterior shoulder strength. And have some what we would call like scaption based work or Y based patterns, like lie on the floor, hands by your shoulders, elbows in a W position, and pressing out your head into a Y. Just drill that sort of stuff. And then I like just having some posterior deltoid stuff, because it's often the one which I think gets forgotten. So reverse fly type patterns. So you can have a little TheraBand X circuit that you do at home, which takes you 10 minutes. You do it on non-train days, we would always get our guys to do pre-pull before they got in the water. So if you train at a place where you can do 10 minutes before you get in the water, that's a great time to do it because you're getting your microdosing, so I'm drip feeding stimulus. I'm also giving the shoulder a little bit of a neurological nudge, telling it what I want it to be able to do for the session that's coming ahead. So I might squeeze a little bit more out of it because I've prepped the shoulder for the workout that's coming. So that's one way to go. I always caveat that because people are like, oh, after all that, it's just band exercises. Like they work. Right? So, but it's picking your tools effectively. The other way to go down the route is I would, for most people in triathlon and swimming, I would like master your own body weight. Like do that. Like, and you can do it from home. You can do it with a pull-up bar in your gym, or in your garage. You can get a portable pull-up rack or a door frame pull-up rack. Like you don't need to have a full gym setup to be able to get some really good benefits. So can you go full dead hang to full chin above bar pull-ups, like repeatedly? Because that's your swimming stroke, right? That's, we will use pull-ups a lot for getting stronger into that overhead shape. Can we do that without arching the back and flaring the rib cage? Because if I can, and I've got strength at length from my, in my overhead position, and I don't flare my rib cage, that means that when I produce force, I'm actually connecting my streamline position better. I would have people come into the gym, not training from the performance center where I was based, but they're coming from a different center, but 40 kilos, and these are freestyle swimmers, 40 kilos around the waist and just do a pull-up, but they're like, there's like the back was bent all over the place, like a jackknife type setup. And I was like, what happens if you try and do that without compensating in the spine? Because that's what you need to do in the water. Otherwise, we're going to have this putting the brakes on with the back extension or the curvature of the spine. So get really good at that side of things. Bodyweight dips. If you've got the shoulder range of motion, you can do them. They're a great exercise. Get a set of gymnastics rings, hook them over a beam or a tree and do that from an upper body perspective. That is, I would think you will struggle to convince me that there's a better piece of equipment for the investment value that it is at 30 quid for a decent set of gymnastics rings. And for what you get back from them, like you cannot tell me there's a better piece of equipment for the upper body. When we go to South Africa, I travel with mine. I pop in my backpack and I take them because they literally weigh 2 kilos.
Those are just rings on straps. So you wouldn't, would a TRX be as useful?
Yeah, but to be honest, those suspension trainers aren't as good and they're more expensive. So a set of rings, like a nice set, wooden set with some thick straps. My advice would be don't buy the cheap ones because the straps are really narrow and the buckles snap. So spend an extra £5 or £10. Get a big cam buckle with a thick strap. The wooden ones are lighter than the plastic ones. So if you want something which is portable, that's a better option to go on. And the benefit with the rings is you can separate the anchor point. So often with a TRX or a bodyweight trainer, the anchor point is in a V shape. So when you try and use it, they basically rub and they're pretty uncomfortable. And they also come with this little slip in it. So because it to help you to align it. Well, when you are doing things dynamically on the rings, what you don't always want is that slip to come on when you're not expecting it. So the gymnastics rings for me are just more secure. You can set them up better.
Do you get those from people like Wolverson then?
Yeah, they'll do them. Yeah, we work with the guys at Bulldog. Bulldog Gear will do them. They're super, as I say, you can find lots of people doing those now. But CrossFit has done a great job for us on that side of things, to be honest. It's like just that's become pretty commonplace in most equipment suppliers. And you just need a bar or a tree or something to hang off. So we do a lot of prescription on those. And you can do rows, pushes, pulls, pull-ups, dips. You get further down that road, I will get people doing... you know, like an old like rollout position, but we'll get people using the rings and then doing sweeps. So we're actually now starting to train that shoulder in that kind of like prone position. But like you find how weak you are in these kind of shapes. It's all about building that robustness in different positions and patterns, and the gymnastics rings allow you to do that.
And it feels to me, you know, I love all of this stuff like you probably do. I get very excited when I watch videos of people who are good at it doing those and thinking of the possibilities. They do take a bit of patience to master them and a degree of a willingness to hold yourself back. Because you know what most type A characters do? They'll try and do the hardest one straight away and end up injuring themselves. But it feels to me like in terms of functional, usable strength, the sort of stuff that we've talked about today is far more beneficial for athletes than just going into the gym. As we said, it has its place, but then just going into the gym and throwing around the heaviest weight you can lift.
Yeah, for sure. the good thing about the rings is that they are massively humbling in that you can't hide. So it'll expose where your weak link is before. It's very different to lying on a bench and seeing if I can put more weight on a bar. And the other great thing about them is because, let's say we're doing horizontal pulls and pushes, if you need to change the intensity anytime, you just move your feet forwards or backwards and we can scale it. So you might be that you start off and you go, crack, your set's getting hard. Just move your feet two steps forward and all of a sudden you do the same exercise, but you decrease the load, which means you can continue to move well, which is the biggest thing. But when you, as I said before, you look at return investment, I'm getting shoulder strength, shoulder stability, and I'm getting core strength. Those are all super important things for triathletes and something I would have in the program. So if you're looking for a minimal investment, minimal effort, big return in for your training, that's the direction I would go in.
Yeah, and I had another chap on recently. I don't know if you've come across Dave Schmitz, who is known in America as the band man. His whole business is built up around those loops, the resistance band loops. And that's his whole reputation. And we had a great podcast and he's got some really good videos on his YouTube channel. But a set of resistance bands and some gymnastics rings to go on holiday with are easily portable. You can take, like you say, you can take them and hang them around a tree or in a children's playground and do some stuff really easily.
Yeah.
And you can do a full body workout, so there's no need to miss all that stuff. And again, one of the resistance arguments, as in reluctance arguments that we get from endurance athletes is, well, if I start lifting weights, I'm going to put weight on and then that's going to slow me down. So you're not going to get that sort of hypertrophy from using rings and bands.
You know, people that say that don't know how hard it is to put weight on.
Well,
like if you're an endurance type person, like endurance sports, you're probably predisposed to not putting on weight particularly easily, because people that don't run long distances. So your body composition might change. I actually lost weight when I started doing more calisthenic stuff, but I became far more athletic because I lost a bit of bulk, but my strength to weight ratio went through the roof, which is actually what is more important to people from a performance perspective into the context of swimming particularly. So yeah, if somebody ever uses gymnastics rings and gets too big, let me know, because you'll be the first person I've ever seen to that happen to you, which is some kind of athletic phenomenon.
I had a chap on the podcast, he's been on a few times, called Dr. Dan Plews, and Dan's one of the fastest age group long distance triathletes in the world. But he's called time on that part of his career now. And he said, actually, I'm getting into lifting weights now. But he said, exactly the same as you. He said, I'm trying to put on some bulk. It's so hard. He said, all those people who say, I don't want to lift weights because I'll get heavier. He said, try it. He said, when I'm not doing all the aerobic stuff, I'm still struggling. I'm having to eat like twice what I used to. Yeah. And it's still not going on very quickly. So, yeah. Well, Tim, I feel like we've gone down a lot of rabbit holes. We've covered some great stuff. And hopefully we've not only encouraged people to look after the shoulders, but also encouraged them to consider resistance training. Let's call it that rather than lifting weights, and some very inventive and creative ways of doing that. So I appreciate your input and your sharing your knowledge with us. It's been
an absolute pleasure.
Fabulous and a good education for me as well.
Yeah, I hope there's some things that people can take away. And this might be the starting point for people, and they just go like, oh, I'm intrigued as to what you're talking about and what it might look like. And if you want to find out a bit more, then our Instagram page, Dynamic Shoulders, is where you're going to find, we put loads of content of exercises and stuff you can try, and you can get a bit of a feel for what it might look like and where the options and that sort of stuff are. But I would just encourage you to do something and then use it like I did right back in the beginning with the handstand. Not necessarily that skill, but if you haven't been resistance training and you're interested to see how it benefits your performance, give it 3 months of consistent effort. That's what I said with calisthenics. I was like, I'm going to do 3 months. If I don't like it, I can always go back. But give it 3 months, see how you feel, see how your body feels, and then let that be the deciding factor as to whether you keep it in your program, whether you think it adds value to your program or not. And even in that case, it might be you go, it's too much to do all the time. Well, then you need to find a stripped down version of what's the most, I talk a lot about minimal effective dose. What's the least amount of work you can do to get the most amount of change? That's where your sweet spot for a sport like triathlon is going to be, because you've got so much other competing training elements, which you need to kind of factor into your week. 3 times in the gym is probably unlikely. So what can you do to get the biggest return on investment from the least amount of time commitment?
Yeah, minimum effective dose is a favorite term of mine. It just doesn't go down well with people who just like doing more and more and more.
I think people think I'm being lazy when I say minimal effective dose. I could have to train as hard. It's not. It's about being able to do the least amount of work so I can do more of the stuff which actually matters.
Well, I mean, if you did business, you probably, when you did economics, you talked about diminishing marginal returns. And there is a point, isn't there, when you've gone past minimum effective dose that, yes, you will get returns on doing more, but the amount of return you get for each unit added on is less and less and less until you get to the very top where you've got to do huge amounts of work for, well, milliseconds, really.
Yeah. And one last thing before I let you go, Simon, I'm not taking out your podcast, but just evidence, right? The amount of times I've seen this all the time in shoulders, but one of the guys first saw this was a guy called Rich Whitehead, who I worked with, who was a double leg amputee. So he used to deadlift off his knees, and we would put him on a block, on like a stacked box, and he would deadlift from the floor. So we'd been working together for quite a few years at this stage, and we'd done London, and we were kind of in the preparations for Rio. We go, well, how do we get this guy to go faster? Because our law of diminishing returns was kicking in and going, it's actually quite hard to get more deadlift strength because we were doing 200 kilos. So we said, oh, we're going to switch this. And in the pre-season or general preparation phase at the beginning of the year, prior to Christmas, we just went motor control and stability. That's all we did. We didn't lift any heavy weights. We maybe did a little bit of maintenance work on these key patterns. He came back in and tested his 3-rep max deadlift in the January after a block of, say, let's 8 to 12 weeks. And he goes 220 for three for the same rep range. So he put 10% on a 200 kilo deadlift by not lifting heavy weights. So, and the shoulder works the same way, but a little bit of the right stuff can actually break through that plateau that you're experiencing. So you never know what the performance opportunity is unless you kind of maybe just think about it a little bit differently, but then commit to a strategy and see how it plays out.
Yeah, and you know what? We should leave it there because there'll be a lot of people going, what is that sort of work he was talking about to get that? We maybe should have that in another podcast.
It's less sexy than what you think it is. It's actually really, it's the hardest type of training to do, but it is massively effective.
Tim, it's been great. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I hope that we can get you back on in the future. Maybe we'll have some Q&A or something, but it's been great. And I'm probably going to book in for an appointment and see how you can help my shoulders.
Yeah, great. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Simon.
Thank you again to Tim for being my guest on the show this week. And like Tim, I've had a few shoulder problems over the years, so I'm definitely going to be putting into practice some of those ideas that we talked about in the show. And to make sure you don't miss any future episodes, please go to iTunes, search for High Performance Human Triathlon Podcast, and then click the subscribe button so that each new episode will drop straight into your podcast platform every week. And when you finish listening, I've got a couple of favours to ask. Firstly, please could you share this episode with just one person you think might benefit? And if you've got a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform. And that would be absolutely amazing if you could do both or one of those for me. Before you go, make sure you check out the show notes for links to most of the items that we've mentioned above and maybe from some previous episodes. And that's all for this week. I'll have another great guest in 7 days' time, and I hope that you'll be able to join me. But in the meantime, enjoy your weekend and happy training.